This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodi. With architecture being a cultural practice played out in the public sphere, Persatuan Architect Malaysia are hosting the inaugural PAM Public Lectures, which takes a cue from the critical agenda of the 2014 Venice Architecture Biennale. The first speaker for the series is internationally acclaimed architectural curator Kayoko Ota, who joins us to discuss contemporary Japanese architecture and its future directions and challenges. Welcome to the show, Kayoko. Yoko, how are you today?
Brilliant. I saw the weather forecast, continuous rainy days, and it's actually continuous bright, fantastic days.
What do you think of the architecture here in Malaysia?
It's very interesting. Of course, the Petronas Tower has been, you know, world famous, and then, you know, it was to the Japanese eyes, it was even shocking and, you know, very future heading. But now I was surprised that it's completely surrounded by many others competing with each other. So it's very, very, I think, thriving.
Is that necessarily a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's inevitable. I think this is happening in all over the world. And I think it's just, the contemporary force that is very hard to fight with, that I think you have to live with it.
Kayoko, your job description reads as architectural curator. Mm-hmm. What does an architectural curator really do?
Yes, it's a good question because it's still not so much in need or kind of recognized as a profession. I also started as a kind of inevitable kind of development of my relationship with Rem Koolhaas and OMA. In 2002, OMA was commissioned to organize a retrospective exhibition, a major exhibition in Berlin of its own work. And Rem decided to show not only the architectural work of OMA, but at that time he had already had a think tank who works in the other fields than architecture, and it was already doing a really interesting work. So he decided to do it together and in a national gallery in the Potsdamer Platz. And I was invited to work as a curator of the exhibition. Now, of course, museums work on architectural exhibitions and they're curators. But art curation and architectural curation is quite different. And architecture, since it's not pieces of art, it's quite a different media. So the profession is still just emerging and in a long process of developing, and I kind of initiating, and that's why I'm calling myself as an architecture curator, because I think it will be a very interesting profession in eventually. And it's also necessary to communicate architecture better to the non-professional people.
Why is there that need? Why is the need to communicate to the non-architects?
I find I have continuously been frustrated by the gap between what is discussed or done among the professionals and how the non-professional people perceive architecture with a growing interest, but really do not understand. And therefore, there's been a kind of, as a result, the unfortunate kind of developing out of this disparity, the in a way, fantastic misunderstanding of architecture on the one hand. Mm-hmm. And then on the other, I would even say the very complacent understand or treating of the profession as a professional. And I think that we need like something in between to bridge the two sides.
Do you think architects around the world are challenging status quo?
In general, there are few. I would not deny that it's none, but I think it's very, very little, not enough challenge being done. And this is what I'm going to talk about tonight.
Why are we not challenging the status quo?
First of all, architects are very busy and then really, you know, have to work hard to survive first. And that's already a difficult enough thing. But it's also hard to see themselves more objectively, you know, stepping outside of the circle they work on a day-to-day basis and take a more kind of global view and on a long term. Then I find it is super critical. The profession is a huge crisis. But strangely enough, even in Japan, this is not something that you immediately begin kind of, you know, the heated discussion with especially with architects. They find it still kind of remote or not so imminent issue. And so I'm kind of, alarmingly kind of raising my voices, like, look, this is like really, you know, important. You have to start taking action now. And well, there are some people I have discovered, fortunately, among the young generation who do share my view and are already doing some initiatives.
How do you maintain a cultural perspective while challenging the status quo at the same time? Because this whole idea of contemporary is anything and everything, in my opinion. Mm. But how do you still hold on to, you know, traditional culture without letting... How do you stay true to your culture still?
Yes, I think it's a very good question, because the superpowers who are more or more predominant in the urban areas... I think everywhere in the world, it's an inevitable direction of urban architecture, then I do think that this element of very precious kind of cultural background is disappearing, and everything is turning into a more and more generic and sustainable and economically profitable, sustainable in a condition. And so I think that we need to find a way to recover the quality of culture, as you pointed out. And how to do that is a really, really tough work. But I think that first we need to realize that there is a crisis, and then people need to take action to work on it.
Mm-hmm. Who would have thought that architecture was in crisis, right?
Yes.
In order to challenge the status quo, you need to imagine that there is a crisis. Do I have to imagine it, or is it really happening?
It is already happening. I mean, if you put all these things together that are already familiar to you, then if you see them all together, then you have to realize that there is a crisis.
I understand what you're saying now. Yes. Yeah, then that makes a lot of sense. Most recently, you were the exhibition commissioner for the Venice Architecture Biennale in 2014. You said that the pavilion celebrated the architects that challenged the status quo in the 1970s. Who were some of these architects, and how did they do it?
It's a very interesting discovery that we made, thanks to the Biennale, thanks to the mandate of the director, Rem Koolhaas. Because he said, each pavilion should work on the history of the 100 years of modernization. And so we also look at the 100 years and then decided after, you know, like heated discussion that maybe the 70s is the most critical period in the whole, the century. Because strangely and surprisingly to everybody's surprise, the people in the 70s, for instance, okay, going back to your question, Tadao Ando, Toyo Ito, they are like internationally famous names. Mm-hmm. And also lesser known are Hiroshi Hara. He's the superhero of the Japanese architecture still today, like a rock and roller in architecture, we call him. Riken Yamamoto, and like their whole kind of generation who were working together. As you know, all as a frustrated particles of the society who arrived after the super powerful generation, typically represented by the metabolism or Kenzo Tange, their master generation, they took the whole show, and then there was nothing left to their younger generation like Ando and Ito. And the country was hit by the energy crisis, mm-hmm, in 1973. So they really had to struggle and desperately finding a way to survive as human beings themselves. And also, they had to connect them as a professional architect to the society, because there's total kind of sever between the two. So it was a kind of personal survival story. And so if you see closely, try to discover what actually they did, you had to dig out all of the archives that they keep personally, kind of separately. Then you begin to understand, like, wow, you know, you did this. I mean, what, for instance, Osamu Ishiyama, he is also the superhero of the 1980s and 90s, and still he's kind of retired now. But if you find what he actually did in the 70s, it's a very heroic story because he, as an architect, also became a tradesman, started to import American kind of housing units to Japan and transform them into like something marketable but with quality, architecture quality. And he did all kinds of kind of networking actions. You know, he was an activist, very much influenced by the San Francisco hippies. But also Toyo Ito also did something totally different, but also on his own as a private initiative, involving Kazuo Sejima, who was a very, very young female, unknown architect, and she was part of the group to research. Like they did a kind of 2 or 3 years kind of research to reconnect the architecture profession into the market, but coming with the quality in everybody's home. But this fact was totally forgotten or unknown. And so if you bring together all these bits and pieces together, then you have this whole generation kind of working more or less together and with the same spirit to fight against the status quo and also trying to redefine the Japanese architecture in the whole generifying process of modernization. So what is what we need to keep and need to enhance, and what should we really be doing as an architect? So they did this whole revamping work.
And they were the metabolist movement.
They came after metabolism. Yes.
After.
Yes.
What was the metabolist movement?
The metabolist movement was the generation of those who actually experienced the Second World War. And as kids, like teenagers, they all saw the overnight destruction of cities and fiascos and the urban ruins. And so they had a very particular way of imagining the future. And so they actually made many, many beautiful visionary plans, proposals for different cities. And people now think that they were all visionary, but all these projects were real projects with real sites. And together or collectively or individually, they are making, you know, protest with this proposal to the whole society. So this is something like really I got a lot of inspiration from what they do. But as a result, they became quickly successful as practitioners in the 60s. And by the time that Japan and these people together had this kind of apotheosis in the Osaka Expo in 1970, then there was this huge reaction against them and hit by the energy crisis. So the new generation really struggled to fight against and go beyond them.
And hence the 70s, the architects that you spoke about just now.
Exactly.
Who were actually influenced by this challenge.
Yes.
We'll come back. You know, Japan has been in an economic crisis for 20 years now. We'll come back and find out where the architectural scheme of things is actually moving towards and what's actually inspired them over the last 20 years. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Break, coming back. Okay. Good afternoon, I'm Mira Sivasodi. The Persatuan Architect Malaysia has launched a lecture series, and we have Kayoko Ota, who's an architectural curator. She's discussing Japanese architecture at Crossroads, its challenges and scenarios in the first lecture, actually. Kayoko, as I mentioned, Japan has been in an economic crisis for 20 years now. How do you think the architectural landscape has changed from the 70s, you know, and moving on after?
So after these young kind of Protestants or frustrated particles, did all kinds of actions and protestations, then I think in this period they kind of cultivated their talents, and more people than the others, they became successful. Most notably, Tadao Ando. Now he is the superhero of architecture in the whole. You know, everybody knows him, knows about him, and so they became famous, but as a kind of like the so-called star architects. So what I mean by this is that they are invited to crucial projects for big entities like cities or big corporations, and you know, to create public zones or public spaces. But I think that what people expect of them is a kind of iconic architecture. And also in Japan, probably as well as other countries, these architects did not particularly cultivate their ability to work before the starting to work on the drawing board. What I mean is that they start the work from after all the conception for planning, you know, what to build and how to what kind of program to put into the building, and how they, you know, manage it in a due course. These things were not in their scope of work. So this very, very crucial part had been already taken over by developers, more developers than city officials, and or construction companies, or even advertisement companies. So that important phase has been taken over by them, the others. And the architect's scope of work has been marginalized to only kind of giving shapes. And in a way, that's enough. Mm-hmm. People are not asking more than that. And I think that's where the problem lies.
And what would you say is fundamental to Japanese architecture now?
I think the disparity that these talented architects are disappearing from the center of the city. And if we go to the central palace and then surrounded by the whole CBD zones, you don't see any buildings designed by singular name architects, but they're all, you know, the coalition of big entities, the big, you know, power, but the big monies, except for some exceptions where only the facade is designed by named or foreign architects. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we spoke about economic challenges, but what about political challenges? How would you describe the relationship between architecture, design, and politics in Japan now?
Yes, I think, unfortunately, it's very kind of in a stasis. And we need more interaction between them, because the politicians do not recognize architects having any kind of a political kind of stake, because they're just designers, like very, you know, they're taking very superficially, just like an industrial designer, or you know, they're replaceable, and they're not in the scene of making the fundamental planning. Or direction, giving direction to the specific site in the urban territory or regional territory. So there's no, you know, scene where these people meet together and talk together. And now the new national stadium in Tokyo, and there was a big international competition for it, and Zaha Hadid won the competition. And now, which turned into a huge scandal.
Because
first of all, people were really frustrated by the fact that it was too gigantic. And the decision was made without the involvement of the citizens, just by the committee who was related to the IOC, the Olympics Committee. And so it was really kind of something, you know, such a huge, public expenditure was decided by the people, totally irrelevant to what people, the citizens think. So, and it is oversized and over-budgeted, like three times as much as the budget. And so it became obviously a big scandal. And now it has been, the project has been trimmed over and over. And now the project looks completely different than the competition winning proposal, which I think was beautiful. But now it's something, you know, well, what is this? You know, to everyone.
If this attitude continues, where do you think architecture in Japan is actually heading towards?
Yes. So that incident reveals that, okay, architecture is not the major concern for politicians. It is replaceable. It is revisable. And as long as it meets kind of political adjustment, it's okay. And this is a very different approach to when the previous Olympic Games in 1964, when Kenzo Tange made a similar the stadium for the Olympics, and it's a now totally different political climate.
What is your personal approach to design?
My personal approach to design is, I think on the one hand, you do need a genius of creativity, but also this is something that you're not born with, but you can also train it. But on the other hand, that's not enough. And on the other hand, I think you need to have a very broad social viewpoint and a will to be involved in the life of the building in the long term with the users, with people who pay for it and who activate the space within. And so it's much more complex and vibrant profession than the status quo.
Do you also think the whole idea of architecture in Japan is the way it is today because culture is very difficult to define in this day and age? I mean, with globalization, anything is culture, really. It's one that cannot be defined anymore. And do you think that could be one of the reasons why architecture is heading the way it is in Japan today?
Yes, I think that's an interesting observation.
Because it's very subjective.
Yes, it's very subjective, and probably the people who are working on the center of Tokyo may think that they might be confident with the culture they have.
Yes, and it is different. Yes. Japan has got traditional culture, you have contemporary culture. Mm. So, you know, what inspires your design today?
What inspires my design today is the people who have a really long-term vision, and who are genius in putting, you know, diverse factors into an architectural composition.
Does an architect have a responsibility?
I think so.
And what is it?
Responsibility for the life that takes place in the building or around the building. Not only for the time of completion, but for the whole life, the longevity of the building.
Do you think there's a shared perception of an architect's responsibility within the profession?
In practice, no. And this is why, for instance, in 2005, I edited with Rem Koolhaas this issue called Domus da Torre, and it's called post-occupancy. Post-occupancy means that the life of architecture after the completion date. Because in practice, architects leave the site after the completion and never bother with it. But actually for the users, that's the day one of the life of the building.
What does this book tell you?
So there's a life and of the building, and according to how it is designed with a long-term vision or more with a more involved status of the architect, with the scene, with the life scene, then you have a more vibrant life, and you know it also can be kind of maintained or managed, and so architect can continue to be responsible for the transient life of the building, And so, like, it doesn't mean that the building should stay there as it is for the rest of the life. But I think that, you know, from time to time, that also architects should be invited to work together to transform or modify according to the needs and time. But this is not happening usually.
Okay. And are more and more people buying into the concept?
I don't know. I think it's still a very alien idea, unfortunately.
Right. But it makes a lot of sense.
Yes,
it really
it does
makes
make
a lot
sense.
Of sense.
Yes.
How do you think designers mediate the tension between personal experience and shaping a universal message through your work? Because you have a personal, idea. You have, there's you in architecture. It's design. It's art. There's always an element of you in it. But how do you mediate that tension? You need to also make a universal impact as mm-hmm. such. You know, in this world, I mean, you've got people from all over the world coming to visit. How do you mediate that tension?
I think that if you are designing drive stems from the really truly shared frustration or imagination or response to social changes or needs, then I think the more kind of persuasive or more gripping the message of design is. And I think that also applies to architecture.
Do you think it's important to revisit history outside of the traditional narrative?
Revisit history?
Yeah.
Yes, I think you always should revisit history, because history is something that also keeps changing according to the viewpoint. And there are many, many histories. And what I did with the Project Japan, for instance, is the history about the metabolism that I explained about. 30 years after the wave of metabolism, then there were so many things that you could rediscover or correct the previous understanding. And that is only for the future, that you can always regain the new messages, new energy out of history. So this is something you must keep doing.
Architecture of the past, architecture that's present at the moment, are all going to inspire the future generation. What do you think the future generation of Japan has to look forward to?
I'm looking forward to the more merging of the two extremes, the iconic architectural creative talent on the one hand. Well, it doesn't have to be iconic, but creative architectural talent on the one hand, and then also non-formalistic efforts to be involved in the society on the other. And so these two things are very different. But I think that architects, most of the architects belong to the first category. Now they have to expand their capacity to the second.
Would you have a message for us here in Malaysia?
Yes, I think that now, like spending 1.5 days in Malaysia, I was surprised that the condition is pretty much in common with Tokyo. And also, I was talking to one architect who kind of invited me to the PAM, the conference, and he organized the conference. And I think that he is very much, to my mind, on the same page, and we really share the mission for the future.
Thank you very much for joining me today. That was Kayoko Ota, architectural curator here in Malaysia, to present at the Persatuan Architect Malaysia public lecture on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.